It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let food be thy medicine. Words of the ancient Greek physician Hippocrates, also words capturing the groundbreaking achievements by this year's World Food Prize laureates. And we'll hear from all four of the 2016 World Food Prize laureates this hour. It's the first time, as a matter of fact, in the award's 30-year history that four people were declared the winners, and they will be presented their awards on this Thursday, October 13th, in Des Moines. The four recipients will split a $250,000 prize. What ties them all together in their work? Something called biofortification. That's what we'll learn about this hour. And in short, it's breeding critical vitamins and micronutrients into staple crops with the aim of reducing hidden hunger. That's the term, hidden hunger for millions of people, sort of a nutrition revolution. Collectively, the work of the people on this program today has given more than 10 million poor and hungry people around the globe access to food containing vital nutrients. Let's meet one of the award winners. Howard Buis is with us, founding director of Harvest Plus. He began his work in the mid-1980s at the International Food and Policy Research Institute in Washington. In the early 1990s, Buis' interests and research focused on the diets of poor households and nutritional outcomes in Asia. Howard Buis, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Start us off by telling us what this term means, biofortification.
Well, it's very simply using plant breeding, conventional plant breeding, to combine high yields and high profits in crops, but also putting in more iron, more vitamin A, more zinc in the crops.
Mm-hmm. How is that done?
Well, you through conventional plant breeding, you get a high-yielding variety, and you cross it with a high mineral variety. And through the plant breeding process, you get the high-yielding, high-mineral variety.
Mm-hmm. Through gene manipulation?
Well, this is, when you say gene manipulation, it's not a GMO.
Okay. What is it then?
It's what agricultural research institutes have been doing for the last 80 or 90 years to improve yields, pest resistance, disease resistance. Now they're breeding for climate change, for heat tolerance, drought tolerance. And what we're doing is piggybacking on those achievements in terms of improved agronomic properties by also improving the nutrition content of those crops.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit of the story of how biofortification came to be valued so recently, a sort of a before and after picture. How far would we have to go back to get a before picture? What the conventional wisdom used to be?
Well, I started promoting this idea, can we get the plants to do the work, in 1993. There was a lot of skepticism in the beginning from plant breeders. They told me it was a bad idea. Their job was to increase yields, pest resistance, reduce poverty. It wasn't to improve nutrition. When I went to the nutrition community, they were skeptical about how much of the minerals and vitamins would be absorbed. Maybe the levels would be too low and wouldn't do any good anyway. People were questioning about whether farmers would accept the biofortified varieties. So in the 1990s, it was a slow process of gradually getting the evidence together. And then finally, after 10 years, the Gates Foundation gave us $25 million over 4 years, and that got us started.
Mm-hmm. It seems funny in hindsight, doesn't it? Perhaps you can explain a little bit more why nutrition, why people would be so skeptical of adding nutrition rather than, I guess, just calories to these staple foods.
Scientists tend to work in silos. They get better and better at narrow and narrower areas. And our institutions are not set up to have the scientists from the different disciplines talking to one another, working together. And yet that process is a very powerful process, as we've shown with biofortification. We got the nutritionists talking to the plant breeders. They understood their respective constraints. And now we're working in delivery and scaling up, and it's a whole different set of problems and issues with delivery.
Mm-hmm. When the conventional wisdom was changed, can you tell us about a turning point when that conventional wisdom was cast aside, and the new thoughts were adopted.
Well, I think in the beginning, when the Gates Foundation gave the first grant, I think that that gave us a lot of credibility. When the crops were beginning to be released, they were tested by varietal release committees for 2 years. Showed that the agronomic properties were very good, that they were high yielding and profitable, and people saw us that we've released crops now in 30 countries around the world. And when people hear those kinds of statistics, then they start to believe.
Mm-hmm.
On the nutrition studies, not only have we shown that iron status, vitamin A status improves, but we've shown functional outcomes. So, for example, children in India eating the high iron pearl millet, we've shown that their cognitive functions improve. Women in Rwanda eating high iron beans, their work performance improves. Children eating the orange sweet potato in Mozambique, the prevalence of diarrhea has been reduced. So when we have all this evidence now gathered, I think people understand now that biofortification works.
Mm-hmm. And the populations that started eating these more nutritional foods, how quickly did they notice, or did they notice quickly, that the better foods, the more nutritional foods, would change in the way that you described, change their health?
Yeah, there's a lot of testimony, especially by mothers in Africa growing and eating the orange sweet potato, that their children born after the adoption of the orange sweet potato, when it became part of their diet, that they felt that their children were healthier, they grew faster, they just seemed brighter and more healthy.
Mm-hmm. Aside from the orange sweet potato, what are some of the other crops? You say 30 crops around the world now?
Not 30 crops. We've released biofortified crops in 30 different countries.
Okay.
So the crops that we have in Asia are high zinc rice, high zinc wheat, high iron pearl millet. In Africa, there's the orange sweet potato. There's orange maize, high in provitamin A. There's yellow cassava, high in provitamin A. And we have high iron beans in Africa as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those crops are now also released in Latin America.
Howard Buis is with us, founding director of Harvest Plus, and one of the four winners of this year's World Food Prize. And I didn't say it at the outset. Let me say it now. Howard Buis, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to recognize that it's a team effort. It's the accomplishments of a large number of scientists, institutions, organizations all over the world. So it's our collective achievement. Thank you very much.
Howard, let's meet some of the other recipients of the 2016 World Food Prize. Robert Monwanga is with us. He's a sweet potato pioneer in the studio in Des Moines with you. Robert, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Now, you're focused in on the sweet potatoes. You've been involved, I understand, in nearly all aspects of this orange sweet potato. Genetics, breeding, educating people about their nutritional value. You take us back, please, to because I understand you grew up on a farm. Tell us what farming was like in Uganda, where you come from, in the 50s and 60s, before this type of food engineering was prevalent.
Well, farmers and consumers were used to eating white-fleshed sweet potato or yellow-fleshed sweet potato, and those kinds of sweet potato are a staple. So they were not used to eating orange-fleshed sweet potato because they were not available. Now, when we came to learn that orange-fleshed sweet potato is important for eyesight to children, lactating mothers, and pregnant mothers to reduce vitamin A deficiency, then as breeders, we embarked on introducing orange flesh sweet potato varieties from other countries, Latin America, from China, and from International Potato Center in Peru. The problem was these orange flesh sweet potato were watery. They were not as good as the what the consumers were eating as a staple. And so when they were grown on research stations, they would be, and when tested by farmers and consumers, they said, oh, these were not good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to start a process of breeding, that is crossing the local varieties grown by farmers and the introduced varieties to produce varieties that were adapted to conditions in Africa. I'm from Uganda, so conditions grow in Uganda we have viruses. Now, when we introduce those varieties from other countries, they were wiped out by viruses.
Hmm.
And so we had to breed varieties resistant to viruses and to another disease, which is a foliar disease called Alternaria. And then the other trait we had to work on, characteristic that we had to work on to improve, was dry matter, because we had to increase the quantity, the percentage of dry matter in the consumer's varieties, and from around 20 to 30% and over 30%, so that they are appreciated by the consumers. And so when we got those problems fixed, that is the diseases and the growing conditions, and then so we moved on to testing evaluating the new varieties with farmers so that they are acceptable to improve the quality of the sweet potatoes that the farmers were consuming. I should point out that the children have no problem with orange flesh sweet potato, which is soft. In fact, it is good for them because it is easier for them to eat and digest, and so it needs promotional work. But basically, we had to produce the varieties to make them available for the work to proceed.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, Robert, how long you've described the challenges in terms of diseases, in terms of taste, to improve the quality of this particular sweet potato hybrid. How long did that take? How many years? Was it decades or how long?
Conventionally, it takes 7 to 8 years to release a variety you go through cycles of selection. If you have two seasons in a year, as we have in Uganda, but in other places where they have only one growing season in a year, it would take 14 to 16 years to release a variety. And so we went through the first cycle of 9 years to produce the first lot of varieties for testing, and then went through another cycle, so of 8 years, so roughly 17 years, to produce the second set of varieties that were released for conducting actually some of the experiments that Howard has been talking about, referring to.
I wonder if there was Robert, an aha moment after so many years of trying, having the setbacks that you faced, that there was a potato that was dug out of the ground that you tested out, I suppose, in a kitchen, also in terms of its makeup, where you knew this was the potato that you had been striving for.
Yes, because you have to... Because I grew up on the farm, I would appreciate if I produced a variety that that is close to what the consumers and farmers want. But you have still to test it to evaluate it with the consumers, the farmers, a panel of experienced farmers, and that would give the verdict and say, "Oh, this is good. This is no good." And basically, you go through a series of selections and elimination, and then the farmers and consumers give you the verdict. They say, this is wonderful, this is better than what we have, this is as good as the white fleshed ones we have in terms of yield, in terms of suppressing weeds, and they give you a number of traits that they are really interested in, besides the beta carotene, the orange fleshed variety that is high in vitamin A.
Mm-hmm. And did you always know that you were going to arrive at the sweet potato you were looking for? Did you sometimes say, this is not something we can attain, or maybe not in my lifetime?
It was small steps moving forward, because there were a number of countries, national programs breeding for high beta-carotene content, vitamin A content, and it was difficult in that beta-carotene content is negatively related to dry matter. And basically what we did was to select, evaluate huge numbers. We are talking about over 100,000 varieties, potential varieties in a season. And so you have to walk through the fields, throwing out what is not desired, and maintaining the ones that you will keep in the next steps until you get to the final stage.
Mm, interesting. Robert, what is your favorite way of preparing this sweet potato?
Traditionally in Uganda, they are steamed. Basically, they wrap them banana leaves and put banana stems in the pan and cover them with banana stems. And this is cooked over fire, and when it's ready, water doesn't reach the sweet potato directly. And so when you have the sweet potato, the banana leaves impart special flavor to the sweet potato, and then so it's really good.
Mm. Howard, tell us a little bit about the sweet potato, how it fits into the context of all the other crops you were talking about. Is this one of the most successful examples of what we were talking about here, biofortification, or all the others had similar paths to get to more fortified staple crops?
Well, the basic strategy is where a farmer is growing a crop, their family is eating it, we want to replace the non-biofortified with the biofortified variety. So we're in countries and regions where they're eating the sweet potato, it's probably white sweet potato, it'll be replaced by orange. We're not really, you know, so we're working on maize in Africa, we're working on rice and wheat.
Mm-hmm.
The seeds are different. The sweet potato, the cassava, are vegetatively propagated. You use vines. With the rice and the wheat, you have seeds. There are very well-developed seed markets for the rice and the wheat. So there are differences by country. There are differences by crop.
Are these the type of sweet potatoes, in a supermarket in the United States, Howard? We have sweet potatoes or yams, and often people can't tell the difference. Is this what we're buying in our supermarkets here in the U.S.?
Yes, basically it's the same. We're used to eating orange sweet potato in the United States. In Africa, previously they were used to eating white, and we had to adapt the orange sweet potatoes to growing conditions in Africa. And then once that was done, we had to market. We had to explain to farmers about why it would be advantageous to switch from white to orange. But it's basically the same crop.
Mm-hmm. It's all in the same family of tubers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Back to you, Robert. I understand that the government, Ugandan Ministry of Agriculture, wasn't entirely on board at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about that.
Initially, the government invested in cash crops. So research was for cotton, coffee, tea, sugarcane, those crops that would bring in cash to the government.
Mm.
So food crops basically had no were not on the research agenda until they did the prioritization exercise, and eventually the root crops, cassava, sweet potato, and bananas came on the priority list for improving the livelihoods of the communities.
So it wasn't just a scientific struggle, it was a political struggle, Robert, to a certain degree. It sounds like convincing authorities in Uganda to change their priorities.
That's right, especially for getting people on staff, particularly to work and focus on sweet potato, especially on orange flesh sweet potato as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you see as a major challenge when you look at all these crops, Howard Buis? There's the scientific challenge, and then there's the challenge of getting it adopted, and that includes getting the government on board and its entities.
Well, our experience is that when we go to the governments with the crops already released, we say we have a high-yielding variety. It costs nothing extra for the citizens of the country to buy the biofortified crop. We actually had planned only one crop per country, which was a major staple. And then the governments immediately say, why only one of your crops? You're working on six or seven different crops. Why aren't you bringing the other crops to our country? So once we had the varieties and we had the evidence, it was a much different situation than in the beginning when we were trying to convince scientists to work on this.
Talking about the nutrition revolution and talking today with four 2016 World Food Prize laureates. We have to take a break. Please stay with us, Howard Buis. But before we do, I just said a sentence or two about it, but the impact is enormous here. Tell us a little bit about how this nutrition revolution, how many people it has affected and actually where.
Well, one statistic that I'd like to point out is that 1.1 million preschool children die every year due to these deficiencies, vitamin A, iron, and zinc deficiencies. To try to put that into perspective, the total population of Iowa is 3 million.
Mm-hmm.
The metropolitan area of Des Moines is 600,000. So it's a huge number of children, all that suffering that goes on.
Right. And so in how many countries? You said 30 countries.
Yes. We estimate that about 20 million people in farm households now have access to the biofortified crops. Our goal is to reach 1 billion people by 2030. We've identified 32 countries. If we can cover 20% of our food staples, our biofortified food staples, capture that percentage of the total food staple supply, we will have reached 1 billion people. So that's our vision.
Okay, we'll talk more about your vision for the future, the challenges along the way. Howard Buis is with us, as well as Robert Mnanga, sweet potato pioneer. Howard is the founding director of Harvest Plus. We'll be joined by the two other 2016 Food Prize laureates when we return. Maria Andrade, she's also working in an international potato center, along with Jan Lowe, both in Africa. We'll have them share their story about sweet potatoes. If you have any questions, comments for our 2016 World Food Prize laureates, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Talking this hour about the nutrition revolution. Stay with us for the next half hour as we continue our conversation with the 2016 World Food Prize laureates. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News with the honor of talking with all four 2016 World Food Prize laureates. They're all in our Des Moines studio this hour. It's the first time in the World Food Prize's 30-year history that four people were declared winners, and they'll be presented the award on this Thursday in Des Moines. The four recipients will split the $250,000 prize, and we're learning about how their work in this area has benefited so many people, what their work is. It's called, broadly speaking, biofortification, breeding critical vitamins and micronutrients into staple crops, not just calories, but those vitamins and nutrients, and to really benefit a lot of people. Collectively, it's estimated their work has given some more than 10 million poor and hungry people around the globe access to food containing some vital nutrients. Malnutrition, especially prominent in sub-Saharan Africa, that's where about a quarter of the world's 800 million people who suffer from lack of nutrients. That's where they live, and that's where a lot of the benefit has been found. This hour, talking with Howard Buis, the founding director of Harvest Plus, Robert Mnanga, sweet potato pioneer. We talked with them in our first half hour, and now we want to talk with two other recipients of this year's World Food Prize, Maria Andrade and also Jan Lowe. Maria and Jan, welcome to the program, and congratulations to you both as well.
Hello. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben. We're glad to be here.
Okay. Jan Lowe, you were in the U.S., born in the U.S. You live in Nairobi now?
That's correct. I work for the International Potato Center based in their regional office, where I lead the Sweet Potato for Profit and Health Initiative.
Okay, so you heard Howard and Robert talking in the first half hour about this potato. So are you dealing with this same potato or different types of sweet potatoes? Tell us a little bit about that work.
Well, the International Potato Center works on all types of sweet potato, but clearly the vitamin A-rich orange flesh sweet potato is one of our flagship efforts that we work together in collaboration with many partners, including Harvest Plus. And particularly our focus of the initiative is in sub-Saharan Africa because of the very high levels of vitamin A deficiency among young children. And we estimated that we could really help at least 50 million children in 17 core countries that we targeted for the Sweet Potato for Profit and Health Initiative by 2020.
Jan, you are the regional leader for Africa of the International Potato Center. So your role here is exactly what?
Well, in terms of the orange flesh sweet potato research, this has been work that we've been jointly doing, collaborating for 20 years, and especially with Maria and Robert here on the breeding front, they're filling you in on that story. But the research I was most involved in was when I was based in Mozambique. And clearly we needed to demonstrate to the nutrition community that using these biofortified crops, particularly orange flesh sweet potato, that we could make a difference to young child vitamin A status, because people doubted that actually we could make an impact on young child nutritional status. So I think the key here was providing the evidence base. Nobody wakes up in the morning saying, I feel vitamin A deficient. Unlike hunger, you know, if you're hungry, if you're lacking calories, you wake up and you know you're hungry.
But a vitamin A deficiency exhibits itself how?
Well, if it's severe deficiency, usually that means the child is more prone to fall ill. And in extreme cases, of course, a severe deficiency in vitamin A can lead to blindness. But you have levels of mild and moderate deficiency that also impact health. And there's a heavy correlation that's been demonstrated scientifically that really, if you can be vitamin A replete, you can have reductions of 23 to 25% in young child mortality, because vitamin A strengthens your immune system. So really the key that we had to do was how to go out in these settings and raise the awareness among people of the importance of vitamin A to human health, and that we had an entry point for poor households to grow this crop. They're used to growing sweet potato, and if they grow the orange flesh sweet potatoes and they use it properly in young child diets, that we can make an impact on young child vitamin A status. Mm-hmm. So really, the key thing we did was build what we call a demand creation campaign.
And in creating that demand, what resistance did you meet? What was the perhaps even unexpected resistance that you met?
Well, I think like anything that's new, you know, people have to know why is this sweet potato different? So we really sort of built it into a whole educational program around vitamin A. And actually having the orange color turned out to be quite a benefit in marketing. We created an orange brand. Maria can tell you more in detail, but in Mozambique we had a whole slogan, Udosika da Saud, because the language there is Portuguese, the sweet that gives health. And really making people associate the orange color, which you would find in other foods like pumpkins and carrots, as well as the orange flesh sweet potato, making them recognize that vitamin A is critical to health. And most parents, as you can imagine, most caregivers of young children want their children to be healthy. But in a country like Mozambique that had been through a major civil war, in our areas where we did this research, 61% of the women had never been to any schooling. So you had to introduce the orange flesh sweet potato along with a whole community-level nutrition education program to ensure that the young children were eating frequently enough and the orange flesh sweet potato was being used to maximum benefit by doing enhanced porridges with the young children. So the way in which you introduce these biofortified crops, particularly the ones that have vitamin A, so they have a distinct color difference, you really need to combine it with a nutrition education campaign, and we demonstrated scientifically that by doing so and based on consumption studies, we were able to see really doubling or tripling of intakes of vitamin A by the children, and in a later study by the women who were their mothers. And then we also saw an impact on the actual vitamin A status of the young children.
Jan Lowe of the International Potato Center, Maria Andrade, you were also working with Jan, also with Robert on these potatoes. Fill us in. Tell us, this is exciting to hear about the scientific work, but also work in adoption. A lot of challenges we're hearing about this hour. Maria, tell us about your role here, what you found exciting or challenging in developing these potatoes.
Okay, let me give you a brief of when I finished the PhD program in North Carolina State University in 1993, looking into adaptation of this orange flesh sweet potato and other quality attribute. I went back to Cape Verde, and in 1 year I was assigned, I got an assignment to go to Mozambique as a regional agronomist for this network we call SARNET. SARNET is Southern Africa Root Crop Research Network. So the two crops that I was to work with was cassava and sweet potato. So when I arrived in Mozambique in 1996, we very understood that 69% of children in Mozambique were deficient in vitamin A. By then, there was UNICEF was providing supplementation of vitamin A for children, but not all children in Mozambique. It was reached because the country is very big, with very poor access to the road.
So they were providing supplements, so sort of capsules or so forth?
Capsule of vitamin A.
Mm-hmm.
It was then that we he had a meeting, and we decided that one way to really work on this vitamin A, to reduce the vitamin A deficiency in the country, was to use another approach, food-based approach. But there was no orange flesh sweet potato in the country by then. And we start introducing sweet potato, orange flesh sweet potato, from all over the place, like the United States, Peru, some countries in Africa. And we start evaluating them in 1996 massively. And in 1999, with the support of NGOs, we managed to select 9 varieties of orange flesh sweet potato. So it was by then that we released this orange flesh sweet potato. And this orange flesh sweet potato, they were 3 times more, yield more than the local white flesh variety. It was very easy for the Mozambican farmer to adopt because they produce much more. With the flood, I'm sure you heard about the flood in Mozambique of the year 2000, all the white flesh sweet potato in the lowland disappeared. And we took the opportunity to really distribute this orange flesh sweet potato to the flood-affected region. So together, like Jen was mentioning, we realized like if you release this material, just like any other material, white flesh, it will have disappeared in the system. So we create a lot of further social market strategy, branding the orange, creating skirts of the woman in the village, T-shirt. We paint the car to really create awareness to the Mozambican farmer, to the Mozambican consumer, that the orange flesh sweet potato that we are releasing and distributing in the flood-affected region is a different one. They were high in vitamin A, and they are orange color.
Was there any skepticism that you encountered, Maria, with your slogans and about orange-fleshed sweet potatoes?
In the beginning, for example, because the orange flesh sweet potato was new, the Mozambican did not know the orange, so there was a problem. They'll tell you it's not tasty, it's not sweet. But as we evolved through our breeding program, which we start the real breeding program in 2005, because a lot of these introduced orange flesh sweet potato with the drought of 2005 had some problem. Then we start building in this material some more dry matter content, and it become those varieties that we release become material that fit the taste of the male and also some of those women. Mm-hmm. But again, though, the soft of this or the initial release fit the taste of most children because they were easy to make winning food, and it was easy for the children to eat them.
Did you get down with your branding and with your awareness raising down to the level of offering recipes, alternative recipes, or were the recipes there in Mozambique? And basically, they had to apply old recipes to a slightly new and an orange-fleshed sweet potato.
Yeah, actually, like we said, the white flesh sweet potato was always there. Those women in the village knew how to roast or boil it. That's the only way they did it. As our promotion campaign, we diversified the use. So we transformed the sweet potato in several other products, like making cake, making bread, making juice, making different winning food. And that also encouraged those women in the village to really adopt those varieties.
Mm-hmm. You're a native of the Cape Verde Islands. These are islands off the coast of West Africa. You're now here, Maria, in Iowa. Have you been to one of our grocery stores to check out our sweet potato supply?
Not in Iowa, but I've been. I went to school in North Carolina.
Yeah.
So I know the groceries in North Carolina, and I also been checking the grocery in Boston. And usually in those in the grocery you only find the orange flesh ones, and often they are very they're very low dry matter.
Mm-hmm. Very low dry matter.
Yes.
Which means what? That they're juicier?
They are juicier. They are not the kind that are bred in Uganda because they like their sweet potato very, very dry. In Mozambique, or the taste for the Southern Africa, we like them in between. Not very watery, not very, very dry. We want medium texture.
Maria, tell us quickly, we have just a few minutes left, but tell us, what brought you to this area of research?
Yes. When I was born in Cape Verde Island, and as you know, Cape Verde is on Sahelian part of Africa, where drought is always a problem. Food supply throughout the food supply because of the drought it was very little. So at very young age, I had my taste to go into agriculture and to increase the productivity in my own island. When I finished my PhD, my master program, I went back to Cape Verde, and they decide, for example, they will give me, I would become a researcher of maize. But I realized at very early stage that sweet potato and cassava are more drought tolerant, and they could produce much, much more food for my people. And I really initiate the programming in Cape Verde of sweet potato and cassava because I thought it was very interesting from where I could begin.
Jan Lowe, you were born here in the United States. Where?
That's correct. I'm a native of Denver, Colorado, where my parents still live.
Okay, so tell us a little bit quickly about the path that took you to where you live now, Nairobi, and this work.
Well, I suppose I grew up watching too many Jane Goodall films, and I decided from an early age that I wanted to work in sub-Saharan Africa. I was very fortunate when I was at Pomona College to be able to do a study abroad in Kenya, and then I sort of fell in love with working more on the people side, so I switched from zoology to agricultural economics, and then I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Zaire after I graduated in fisheries. So basically, since then, I've been working in sub-Saharan Africa for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, and Howard and Robert, too, I want to have you in here as we finish up the final 5 minutes of our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about the future here, how far we've come. I don't know if we can express that in percentage-wise, in getting the poor and hungry people, the hidden hungry of our country, of our world, fed in terms of nutritional values. Howard, what has left to be done?
Well, the big job now is to mainstream biofortification in a number of organizations. We have to get the private sector involved. We need to get hybrid seed companies for maize and for permillet example. They have to develop their own varieties, market their own varieties. We have to get international financial institutions involved. The World Bank is now including scaling up of biofortified crops and their grants and loans to governments in Africa. We have to get the multilateral agencies involved. The World Food Program in Rwanda is now buying high iron beans and storing high iron beans in their warehouses for emergencies. We have to get international NGOs involved. The World Vision works in 70 countries. They're now getting in their proposals, they're writing in scaling up of biofortified crops, and they're now working on biofortified crops in 15 different countries. So our institutions don't have the kind of reach that these large organizations do, so we have to convince them that this is something they should be doing in their everyday business.
Mm-hmm. Robert, in your future, what are the challenges?
Significant progress has been made, but you know, when you talk about a disease like Ebola, it kills people every day, and people really get awake and frightened. Vitamin A deficiency, for example, also kills numbers every day. If you talk about, for example, Uganda, the prevalence is 32%, but what's that in terms of numbers dying every day? It's 51 children dying every day. But, you know, the decision makers, most of the people do not know what these numbers are. And so there is still a lot to be done by different players to bring these numbers down.
Mm-hmm. Maria, what do you see in the future as challenges?
I believe there is a lot of information already in the shelf. But the breeding also should continue. And also, I see that we need much more investment and much more policy, enabling policy in Africa to let this scale out to take place.
Mm-hmm.
But research is also a must to continue, especially in the breeding side. Because as we release a variety, then we'll see the need to get a better one.
Jan Lowe, anything left unsaid about the future as far as you're concerned?
Well, I see challenge as an opportunity, and this is a very exciting moment for all of us with the recognition by the World Food Prize Foundation of biofortification, because there is so much left to do, and it is an exciting time. The United Nations has just announced that it's UN Decade for Nutrition. So what I see is the opportunity to integrate more nutrition education into the primary school level, with agricultural plots alongside, so we can really have children in sub-Saharan Africa and those graduating from primary school very knowledgeable on the basics of nutrition and lifestyle and having exposure to these crops from the outset. I think there's many, many more very innovative ways that we can get the information out in addition to what Howdy has said. So I think it's an exciting time. And under our Sweet Potato for Profit and Health initiative, we really do want to reach 7 more million households in Africa by 2020. So we know we're just starting the process. But with the support, we hope, from people interested in agriculture and nutrition, we are going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Jan Lowe, for you personally, what is the most satisfying part of this work?
I think the more satisfying part of this work, whenever you get bogged down in the bureaucracy of any job, I go out to the field. And watching a young child eat orange flesh sweet potato for the first time is really fun because they get so excited. They love the taste. They're attracted to the color. And so I think knowing that you can work on something that can truly make a difference to people's lives is a very satisfying field to be in.
Certainly sounds as though, and I can hear it in your voice. Jan Lowe of the International Potato Center, Maria Andrade, as well from the Potato Center, and Robert Mwangwa. He is a sweet potato pioneer working with Maria and Jan. And Howard Buis is the founding director of Harvest Plus. We've been talking this hour about their accomplishment, which is being rewarded by the 2016 World Food Prize. They are the four laureates, and they will be receiving their award this Thursday, October 13th in Des Moines. They'll split a $250,000 prize. And Howard, Robert, Maria, and Jan, it's been a pleasure having you on. Congratulations again to you all, and thank you for turning up here in Iowa to receive the prize.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.